víctimas mediante un comunicado. A casi 5 años de esta tragedia, el 5 de junio de 2009, en los documentos entregados a Presidencia y a la Procuraduría General de la República, los familiares solicitaron al presidente Enrique Peña Nieto intervenir para que se haga justicia y se castigue a los responsables, ya que advirtieron, la PGR cuenta con elementos suficientes para actuar. A decir de Manos Unidas por Nuestros Niños, el incendio fue provocado por 3 personas a su cargo: Carlos Andrés López Mesa, exchofer y guardaespaldas de Juan Carlos Lam Félix, y a su vez, exsecretario técnico del exgobernador de Sonora, Eduardo Burs Castelo. Sin embargo, Carlos Andrés López Mesa fue hallado casualmente muerto 2 meses después de la tragedia por 9 impactos de bala, cuya muerte sigue sin averiguarse, indicó Gabriel Alvarado, abogado del movimiento. Alvarado señaló que tanto la PGR como Presidencia cuentan con documentación suficiente que puede probar la intención de cubrir información oficial de la administración del exgobernador Eduardo Burs, que se hallaba en la bodega donde comenzó el incendio. En entrevista con Noticias MBS, el abogado declaró que fue por cuestiones de horario que la tragedia alcanzó a la guardería ABC, ya que pensaban realizar la quema de papeles durante la noche. Sin embargo, esta se adelantó. Con información de Revolución 3.0, desde nuestra radio, La Voz de los Campesinos, en Huayacocotla, Veracruz, México, reportó Eduardo Méndez Salas.
Nos vamos a noticias de Chile, donde mujeres sobrevivientes de tortura en centros de detención durante la dictadura de Augusto Pinochet exigen se juzgue a los represores. Raúl Martínez con el informe.
Con 19 años, Alejandra Holzafel fue detenida por agentes de la Dirección de Inteligencia Nacional, el organismo represivo creado por Augusto Pinochet para perseguir y exterminar las organizaciones de izquierda. Desde su llegada a Villa Grimaldi, las vejaciones fueron permanentes.
Desde el momento que llegábamos, que nos ponían, nos sacaban la fotografía, nos ponían un número, nos violentaban revisándonos ano, vagina, oreja, todos los orificios del cuerpo, buscándonos si traíamos algún documento o algún microfilm. Ya por ahí partía, es lo más suave de lo que era la violencia sexual, podríamos decir que fue eso.
El entrenamiento en estas prácticas se hizo a oficiales chilenos en la Escuela de las Américas, donde fueron preparados por especialistas estadounidenses.
De hecho, hay un par de testimonios, incluyendo esta querella, de personas que fueron interrogadas por argentinos, brasileños y norteamericanos, que están presentes en las situaciones de tortura y transmiten esta tecnología del terror, que es al final la tortura.
El sitio denominado Cuartel Terranova por los agentes de la dictadura hoy guarda un parque por la paz y la memoria. Entre 1974 y 1978, cientos de hombres, mujeres y niños pasaron por el centro de detención y exterminio de Villa Grimaldi. Hoy, los sobrevivientes exigen justicia. 4 mujeres, después de 40 años de ocurridas sus detenciones, presentaron una querella en tribunales para reclamar por las violaciones como un acto más de violencia durante su secuestro en centros de exterminio del régimen que encabezó Pinochet.
Tiene que ver, ¿no es cierto?, con que no sean impunes los agentes directos de la represión, ¿sí? Y estamos hablando de los militares, estamos hablando de funcionarios de las fuerzas de orden y seguridad, etcétera. Estamos hablando de los civiles implicados en eso, ¿sí? Cuando hablamos de impunidad, estamos hablando en relación a al propio Poder Judicial. Mucha gente, ¿no es cierto?, que colaboró con la dictadura.
Agentes civiles, suboficiales, coroneles y generales del ejército chileno formaron parte de este grupo de torturadores. Hoy, quienes sobrevivieron a sus vejaciones exigen a la justicia condene por los crímenes que cometieron contra ellas y la historia de este país.
Autoridades en Siria declararon el miércoles ganador de las elecciones presidenciales a Bashar al-Assad. Rafael Cuesta del informativo Más Voces con los detalles.
El martes tuvieron lugar en Siria las elecciones presidenciales, en las que se produjo una alta participación de la ciudadanía para elegir al futuro mandatario del país. Estados Unidos criticó las presidenciales alegando que la decisión del gobierno de Damasco para celebrar estos comicios está desligada de la realidad. En una rueda de prensa celebrada el martes, la portavoz adjunta del Departamento de Estado estadounidense, Marie Harf, agregó que estas elecciones son una desgracia. Además, la portavoz se alzó contra el presidente sirio, Bashar al-Assad, quien desde hace más de 3 años está luchando contra los terroristas apoyados desde el extranjero, indicando que no tiene más credibilidad hoy que la que tenía ayer. Al ser preguntada sobre las duras críticas del ex embajador estadounidense en Siria, Robert Ford, contra la política exterior de Washington respecto a Siria, Harf respondió que todo lo comentado se trata de las opiniones personales de un ciudadano. Y es que, en una entrevista concedida a la cadena estadounidense de noticias CNN, Ford aseguró que las políticas del presidente norteamericano Barack Obama para derrocar a al-Assad no solo han fracasado, sino que han reforzado el terrorismo. Más de 15 millones de sirias y sirios fueron convocados para ejercer su derecho para determinar al futuro jefe de Estado entre Hassan Abdollah al-Nuri, el actual presidente Bashar al-Assad, y el diputado Hafez Hayar. Washington rechaza las presidenciales sirias, mientras que anteriormente había pedido la celebración de elecciones en el país árabe. Desde hace 3 años, Siria se ha tenido que enfrentar a grupos terroristas secundados por algunos países occidentales y regionales, cuyo objetivo es derrocar al gobierno de Damasco. Según algunos informes, se estima que unas 160.000 personas han muerto y millones se han visto obligadas a desplazarse desde el inicio de la crisis. A pesar del rechazo de Estados Unidos, observadores internacionales de países como Venezuela, Irán o incluso Canadá, afirmaron que las elecciones fueron totalmente limpias. Después de la jornada electoral, se ha iniciado este miércoles el recuento de los votos depositados en más de 11.000 urnas colocadas en 9.600 colegios electorales distribuidos en la mayoría de las provincias de Siria. Escuchamos a 2 ciudadanos que ejercieron su derecho al voto.
La participación en las elecciones es muy alta y refleja el deseo de nuestro pueblo de participar en los comicios. Todos quieren votar y expresar su punto de vista y llaman a luchar contra el terrorismo y el derramamiento de sangre. Siria es digna de muchas cosas y está en nuestras manos votar y decir no al terrorismo. Si Dios lo permite, muy pronto resolveremos todos nuestros problemas y todos podrán volver a sus casas. Podremos superar todas las dificultades económicas. Estas elecciones son un puñal en el mismo corazón de los conspiradores occidentales. Es una lección para todos los que traman contra Siria.
Estas elecciones son muy importantes, ya que por primera vez se realizan de forma democrática en Siria. Hemos vencido y estamos muy orgullosos de ello. Hemos derrotado a los terroristas mercenarios que trataban de cumplir sus planes, aprobados por los wahhabistas y sionistas.
Los resultados preliminares demuestran que el actual mandatario sirio, que se había postulado a la presidencia nuevamente, supera a sus 2 rivales, aunque los resultados de los comicios presidenciales serán anunciados el jueves 5 de junio. En el análisis de la crítica de Estados Unidos a las elecciones en Siria, la analista política Concheta de la Vernia dice que Estados Unidos considera autoritario a cualquier gobierno que no sea su lacayo.
Bueno, el problema que tiene Estados Unidos es que para él es un dictador todo el que no sea, pues, un títere a su antojo. Ellos, para tanto Estados Unidos como la OTAN, todo lo que no sea poner el títere que ellos quieran, aunque no haya democracia, ni siquiera un recuento de empadronamientos a la hora de votar, como ha podido ser en Afganistán o incluso en Libia. O sea, lo de Estados Unidos y la OTAN es que no pueden nombrar la palabra democracia ni de paz, porque ellos no la conocen, y alguien que no conoce ni se espera que la conozca no puede nombrar ni paz, ni democracia, ni legitimidad, ni nada.
A menos de 2 semanas de los comicios presidenciales en Colombia, fuerzas progresistas continúan endorsando la reelección de Juan Manuel Santos ante el temor del retorno al poder del uribismo. Así lo hizo el miércoles Clara López, la ex candidata a la presidencia de Colombia por el partido Polo Democrático Alternativo.
Quiero anunciar que voy a votar por la paz de Colombia en cabeza del presidente Juan Manuel Santos.
Asimismo, Clara López llamó a los colombianos que la apoyaron en la primera vuelta electoral a votar por Santos.
Solamente su voto, haciendo valer su voto, podemos avanzar en Colombia hacia la paz, hacia la democracia, hacia la convivencia. Los convoco y los invito a acompañarme en esa gran tarea.
Los partidos opositores en Colombia cifran sus esperanzas en que Juan Manuel Santos concrete un acuerdo de paz con las guerrillas para poner fin a un conflicto de más de medio siglo. En tanto, Juan Manuel Santos ha prometido que de ponerse fin al conflicto, se destinarán los multimillonarios recursos empleados en la guerra a la inversión social. Asimismo, ha prometido que de concretarse las negociaciones en La Habana, se pondrá fin al servicio militar obligatorio.
La guerra lo único que trae es atraso, lo único que produce es pobreza, lo único que nos ha dado a los colombianos durante 50 años es dolor.
La investigadora Juliana Castellanos destaca el alto presupuesto militar que anualmente se dedica en Colombia, en un país con más de 26 millones de personas en la pobreza.
Y hay investigaciones de instituciones serias, estatales, que manifiestan que si el conflicto continúa, pues el país va a seguir invirtiendo entre 20 y 25 billones de pesos anuales en la lucha contra este conflicto.
Residentes bogotanos como Miguel Ángel Salas cuestionan el presupuesto militar.
Llevan 60 años justificando que no hay en educación porque hay gasto para guerra, que no hay en salud porque hay gasto para guerra. Entonces, en ese sentido, cuando se acabe el conflicto, ya no tendrían, digamos, una excusa.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
And coming up next on Free Radio, which you're listening to, 101.3 FM, is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, the June 5th, 2014 edition. Stay tuned. Where is home? Well, if you're outside, it's, I guess, where your friends are. Anyway, welcome to Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, as mentioned before. I'm Robert Norris, and it's going to be kind of a catch-up show, although we may get a few call-ins. I've invited a couple of activists to call in future shows. Tom Noddy is a local street performer organizer who's more famously known as the Bubble Guy, who has been performing over in Europe for half the year and is also concerned about the rights of performers and the powers of performers here in Santa Cruz. And he recently went to a Monday ACLU meeting, which I also held my nose and went to as well. And I may be playing some of that meeting, which I actually taped some of it. The part of it they allowed us to stay at. ACLU is still, thanks to Peter Gelblum and Mike Rotkin, and I have to say, with the compliance of the rest of the board, Steve Plaich perhaps accepted, they've excluded the public. Although, ironically, if you pay $10, you can be an ACLU member and be included according to their rules. Anyway, let's begin with some interviews. And I'm going to kind of sort of be skipping around a bit, but if you find anything of interest or if you feel you have something of interest that relates to the main topic of the show, which is civil rights for poor people and the lack thereof, please call in. The number to call is 831-427-3772. Again, 427-3772. If you want to catch me off air because you have some thoughts you prefer not to do publicly, you can call me on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and that meets weekly every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa at 11 o'clock. It's a downtown cafe. And the phone number to catch me there, that is to say at home, or in Huff Homeland, is 423-HUFF, 423-4833. So do think about calling into the show if you have any thoughts or reactions, any updates, any announcements about what's going on. I guess I really should begin by announcing a few things that I noted are happening soon. There is a protest on First Friday, that's tomorrow, the first Friday of every month, which is also usually a big merchant day. Merchants, you know, actually intensify their monopolization of the sidewalks downtown by bringing out all their knickknacks onto the sidewalk, and that makes it even more difficult for the rest of the community that wants to use the sidewalk for other purposes. But that's only that's not really the problem, because it only happens, I think there are other fairs, but mainly once a month on Friday. The real problem is the merchants take over the sidewalk, have gradually encroached and taking over essentially, I used to say 95% for sitting and spare changing, if those are things you wanted to do, and 75% for tabling and for vending and for performing. But now I would say, having actually studied it more closely, we still haven't got the definitive report yet written up, but Huff has been stalking the sidewalk and walking the sidewalk and trying to figure out exactly how much space there really is left to set up a political table or lay out your guitar case so that it can receive donations as you play the guitar. And at least from the very beginning of the mall at I guess it's Jamba Juice, all the way up to Bookshop Santa Cruz, there's no display device space. There's no place to sit. There's no place to panhandle. Other than in, you can't actually do it in the benches, because if you do it on a bench, that's a violation. You can sit on a bench. That's it. You can't sit anywhere else in terms of doing any busking, in terms of giving out political literature. Actually, that's an open question, but there are very few benches left on Pacific Avenue compared to the number that we were initially put in, or the first we were promised, a smaller number were put in, and then a significant number of those have been removed at the behest of merchants. I'm kind of repeating what I say often every show, and I apologize to those of you who are faithful listeners for having to hear that sort of mantra again. It's true, though, and it has to be underlined and emphasized.
zero places to perform for donation, zero places to set up political table to register voters, zero places to sit down on the sidewalk, zero places to vend your crafts and show your artwork between the end of the mall, which is across from Lulu Carpenter's, all the way up to the bookshop Santa Cruz. Then you find a few spots. And I'm going to be talking more and more detail about what those spots are as time goes on. Hopefully, maybe by Sunday, I'll have gotten the particulars down. And I'll be passing them on, we hope. There is, however, on this first Friday of the month, a protest by women in black at 5 to 6 in front of O'Neill's at Cooper and Pacific. That's a, you know, familiar protest spot. I guess that was the place where protesters urging the U.S. to stop essentially warmongering in the Ukraine as they ramp up the hostility against Russia, which is what's going on there. The media gives a completely different picture of it, but I think I've pretty much become convinced that we are getting a slanted and phony story from almost all the media, mainstream media. It's possible also that, you know, one gets exaggerations and inaccuracies from leftist media, of course, as well. And I don't deny that. And that's why I sometimes grill my lefty friends who come on the show. I'm trying to be as tough with them as I am with those I criticize at the city council or in the police department or on the right, generally in the community, the Take Back Santa Cruz types. And I hope I am, because we need to find out what the truth is here. Ideology aside, we need to find out what's really going on. Anyway, 5 to 6 in front of O'Neill's, Women in Black, and the subject of the protest is going to be Ground the Drones Peace Vigil. And that's the only thing that they said on the Santa Cruz Indy Media site, I think, or maybe it was the Scapel email that I got. There is another report from Brent Adams, one of the final four of the Santa Cruz 11 activists who were picked out by police and district attorneys to be prosecuted, facing initially 7 years in prison, now 4 years in prison. Charges dismissed against all but seven of them, four still remaining, of which Brent Adams is one. And the charges, they were in this vacant bank building during the protest in the latter days, the last days of the Occupy movement in Santa Cruz. Wells Fargo Bank leased property at 75 River Street. Wells Fargo, as has been documented, is a major fraudulent forecloser. Has caused all kinds of economic and personal losses. And the local authorities, as far as I know, have done absolutely nothing about this, either to research it, investigate it, or much less to prosecute it. But D.A. Bob Lee, who is, as I've kind of colorfully described, as a bagman for Wells Fargo, is still trying to squeeze money via Judge Paul Burdick out of the final four protesters, who were with 100 others in the building, in and out, observing the protest, which was intended to create a community center, a protest Wells Fargo Bank, perhaps a shelter for homeless people in the winter of 2011. As we know, in Santa Cruz, there's shelter for less than 5% of the homeless, maybe 10% in the winter, 5% in the summer, or less. And they had a hearing, the Santa Cruz 11, the final four, on, I guess it was on Tuesday. I didn't get to it. I wasn't feeling so good, so I took a breather. And we got this report, however, from Brent Adams, who was actually compelled to go. He was ordered to be personally present. The prosecution district attorney's office has tried to get rid of Judge Paul Burdick to recuse him. Some people praise Paul Burdick for being a wonderful judge, for having dismissed charges against seven of the Santa Cruz 11. I've thought quite the opposite, that he instead has continued to dragged all of us over the coals for months and months. He suborned and allowed fallacious and I would say even criminal prosecution strategies that refused to turn over to the defense documents that we needed. And finally, when it became utterly clear that this was happening repeatedly under the DA-ship of Rebecca Young, who was the DA at that time, in a sense, left, I presume, in disgrace, but perhaps, I don't know, perhaps not. She now works as a reporter in Austin, Texas, who does not respond to emails, I might add, at least not to my email recently. Paul Burdick should have dropped this prosecution long ago, but he wants to find somebody, you know, that he can hold accountable for the damages that happened in the Wells Fargo leased property, which are over $400, and therefore they're a felony. They're sure as hell less than $23,000, which is what the Wells Fargo has claimed in its padded accounting. And the defendants he's charging are poor people. They're not going to be able to pay this stuff. And other prosecutions of other Occupy activists in other vicinities, other locales throughout the country, that have created far more damage and disruption and disturbance, have essentially been either dismissed or resulted in far less penalties, and certainly far less of a huge amount of the time and expense against both the defendants and their attorneys and the whole court system and prosecution and the community, which has spent over $100,000 so far to make a political point, you know, to burnish the badges of Chief Vogel and to fluff up the reputation of DA Bob Lee and to, I don't know, cover the ass of Wells Fargo Bank. It's and to send a message to all the activists, don't you dare take over one of those vacant buildings, no matter how cold people are, no matter how outrageous the behavior of the owners of that building, because private property is more sacred than human life. That's the message. In any case, at this hearing, the attempt to get rid of Judge Paul Burdick by the defense, by the prosecution, by the DA's office, failed. They wanted to get rid of him because he had made a couple of statements and he was really getting weary of this trial. He has expressed that sentiment a number of times. And he, you know, put in a pretty good defense of himself. I read the documents, and he said he could still be an impartial judge. I don't think he's an impartial judge. I think he's a part of a system that is looking for a scapegoat and a victim. But he certainly, you know, is... He's only willing to cook things up so far as I can see. He's only willing to forgive prosecution misconduct so far. And that pisses off DA Bob Lee. So they tried to get rid of him. They failed. That was revealed in court 2 days ago. At the status hearing, they wanted to schedule a jury trial, which will cost another $100,000 for the four remaining defendants. And Brent was there. There were three of the four attorneys there. They filed new motions, again, asking for a dismissal of the charges based on the evidence that not the judge was biased, but that the DA, Bob Lee, was biased, and because he failed to reveal that he had received a sizable campaign loan from Wells Fargo Bank in the past. Thus, he had a conflict of interest that he did not show. Not sure how far this is going to fly with Paul. I'm not going to upset the prosecution too far, Burdick, but it has been made, and it was made by attorney Jesse Rubin, who I believe is Angel Alcantara's attorney. There are four people left: Gabriella Ripley Phipps, Brent Adams, Angel Alcantara, and Cameron Laurendeau. There was a talk of reducing the charges from felony to misdemeanor, as well as reducing the amount owed from $20,000 to a mere $200 for each of the four defendants, given that the police department had counted 200 people entering the building throughout the three-day occupation. Burdick had said if it was possible to round up all the defendants' comrades and get them to pay their portion, then the amount owed by the defendants would be around $100. But, of course, they didn't round up anybody who actually did any vandalism in the building, which is the key charge that is being used to smear and discredit and justify, smear and discredit the defendants and justify the prosecution. So they don't have anybody, but the people that they chose who are high-profile activists, they just happened to catch going in and out of the building, and I was one of them. But, of course, we were there reporting, we were there observing. Some of us were supportive, but none of us, as far as I know, did any planning to take over the building or engage in any criminal behavior in that situation. There are those that say that simply being in the building was criminal behavior. No, a lot of members of the community were in the building observing. If you left and did not come back when you were given a warning, let me put it a little more technically. If the evidence that the police have amassed and that the prosecution presented was that there was no indication that you were in the building after the warning was given, then there isn't even a trespass charge against you. There's nothing against you, which means the entire dog and pony show, the entire dragging of people to court, week after week, month after month, has been bogus. It's been the punishment, as one activist put it. And, of course, the real crime, as activist Becky Johnson has put it, vacant buildings are the real crime. And that, of course, is being ignored in the hysterical justification of the rights of private property over the rights of human beings to have some kind of shelter and the need to expose banker corruption. Because, obviously, the authorities aren't interested until it becomes so glaring that they have no choice but to do something. And nothing was settled on a court date because the four attorneys, a trial date, I should say, at this hearing 2 days ago for the Santa Cruz 11, the four remaining, because the four attorneys have the full schedule, the four defense attorneys, of other cases and summer vacations planned, and the next status hearing was planned for sometime in August. I think there's an earlier hearing as well, I've heard, so maybe on the motions. So I will try to keep you updated as much as I've been updated, and hopefully I will continue to press to get updated as well. So those are a couple of announcements. Let's go into some street interviews.
About 5 o'clock at the Food Not Bomb shindig down here, downtown Santa Cruz. Can you repeat that, Keith McHenry?
Rewatch.
What does this mean to the uninitiated?
That some of the clean plates fall on the ground and have to be rewashed.
Oh.
So you're encouraging the populace to wash their dishes?
Yes, we are.
In fact, you set up a washing table, I noticed.
Yeah, we have a new washing table system. It works really good. You've got the soapy water. You have the sanitizer water and the rinse water.
This is something I've seen years ago when you were doing this in San Francisco.
Correct, yeah. We do this when you have too many people eating and not enough resources. It's made a lot easier.
Now, how many people have eaten today, would you estimate?
I have no idea. I just arrived from the Earth Day event.
How was that?
That was pretty good. We got like 3 pages of volunteers out of that, so that was good.
Now, the pages of volunteers that you get, how many actually show up?
Oh, well, we had great luck here. Look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So it's
April 28th. I'm down here at the Red Church, and it's about 25 to 6, and it's a beautiful day outside. Not too hot, not too cold, and we're talking with...
I'm Val.
Val, you say that you seem pretty sunny today. Kind of goes with the weather. But you also say that you have what problems dealing with the rules in some of these programs?
Yes, I do. I'm on God's time right now. I'm a Christian. I love Jesus all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. And I serve people as best I can. And I can't seem to get with programs that have rules. And they're reasonable. But... I serve a God and filled with the Holy Spirit, and you can't contain the Holy Spirit.
What's an example of a program with a rule that makes it more difficult for you?
Well, we're supposed to be in bed by 10, lights out at 10. Everybody.
With Paul Lee Loft?
Not so much there. They're a little more lax. They make allowances for people's needs, and that people sometimes are slow, and people like me that have early Alzheimer's can't remember everything all the time, and I can't obey because it's not intentional. I don't break the rules intentionally. Mm-hmm. I can't remember everything.
So and talking I'm about another, you're talking about one of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter program? Or?
Well, I was there, and I dismissed myself from ISSP.
You're this year? Or?
Yeah. I was here for a little over a month, closer to 2 months, and I had to dismiss myself.
Because you got in late or got to bed late? Or
I
mean, you are. Yeah. You know, you got to wait until you're 75 in order to really have late bed hours. I mean, you wait till you grow up first.
you don't want to stunt your growth, right?
Second childhood fits just fine. I'm easing gracefully into second childhood very nicely. So, there were false accusations a few times, and then there was, honestly, when I couldn't, I was, I'm not a good example there. I'm not a good soldier of ISSP, so.
Because you go to bed late, or were you doing other things? You're not revealing to us. Shooting up heroin in the bathroom.
Smoking
crack cocaine in the attic.
Well, I just get loaded on the Holy Spirit sometimes.
So you began proselytizing non-Christians?
Yeah.
They were saying, get away from me, you fundamentalist woman, you.
Well, no, they just get away from me, and they cringe, and I can feel what's in their heart, and they really don't like me because I'm a threat to them. So I'm threatening.
Threatening their sleep when they're trying to sleep, and you wake them up with your proselytizing.
No, I threaten them with the love of Jesus and with His holiness. And people don't want His holiness. They don't want to be made clean. People want to live in their little secrets, and they want to keep.
Is it fair to say that you've been? You've ousted yourself from these programs because of the discomfort other people feel because of your, outspoken witnessing.
I don't know. I don't try to preach, or I don't boldly go up to. I'm not very assertive. I don't go up to people and say, "Do you know Jesus?" I don't do that. It's alarming, and it gets people's fences up real quick. So I don't do that.
You say you either excluded yourself or been excluded from programs. Why?
Because I just can't be a good.
Not quiet enough.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Is that the rule we're talking about? You're not supposed to, I don't know.
I'm just not perfect all the time.
Woman. I mean, come on now. You can do better. Jesus loves you. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's.
Or at least that's what they tell me. Anyway.
Well,
that's what you just told me.
Yeah, and he takes me just as I am, and he has something to work with.
Now, are you outside now? Are you?
No, I'm staying at the such and such place on Blippity Blip Street, and
you do have a place to go.
Yes, I do. I have a warm bed.
Not ticketed for sleeping outside.
Yeah, but I can go outside when I need a couple of puffs and a cigarette. I can go out.
Smoking
after.
Again?
Yeah.
That's not good for your health. What would Jesus say?
See,
she's not a perfect, obviously, very imperfect. Anyway, we've been talking.
Bad example.
I mean, bad, very bad. What is your name again?
I'm Val.
Val,
your pal Val.
I'm Robert, and that's it for now.
Anything? Samaritan's dog woman, so I'm a dog. I'm a bad doggy.
Well, we'll be back to woof at you later.
Okay. Wait, one more thing. There are people that are good models, and you'll find me in the wild somewhere. I'm a prophetess, and I'll see you out in the wild somewhere.
You're a model prophetess.
I'm a perfect. I'm not perfect. I do the best I can, and
imperfectly prophetic.
Imperfectly prophetic.
There we have it. Thank you, Val.
Well, thank you. God bless you, and shalom. Jesus is coming back soon. Let's be ready.
Well, I'm not going to comment. What is it? Penny University. There's some discussion of what pharmaceuticals or alternate medicine. Beautiful weather, though, as I said before, and mostly the old crew: Paulie, Gail, Dennis, the usual gang. And Phil Miller is talking inside on his side of the partition.
This is the story of the disciples, and. It's also
missed. And what I'm doing is I tend to check out on Monday afternoons around 5 o'clock, sometimes later, the folks around the Red Church who are mostly poor, mostly homeless, and waiting for food, and sometimes getting into the religious ceremony that is voluntary, but which you can also get coffee at, and you can walk away from the service and still get coffee. But in the same building, there's the Penny University, which is a weekly hour or so, maybe it's a little longer, run by writer and philanthropist Paul Lee, who is usually has some local worthy or maybe out of town worthy speaking. And there's a crew of about 20 folks sitting and listening and firing off questions and discussing. And I've always been sort of... occasionally look in on the group, which is pretty much sort of like a class almost. It's the same group of folks often, although it's open. You know, Paul Lee allows others to come in and out, to his credit. And some folks sometimes distribute flyers there for different events. But they're not really an activist group. They are a group of people who they do it, I think, for the social interaction and for the information they may be getting, and chance to rub noses with the somewhat more famous, perhaps. Steve Plaich, who I used to have on the show regularly and who I used to get reports from regularly, and who knows, may again, has said that he abandoned it because he found it sort of a windbag central or a gab fest, and it was kind of a lot of talk. And, you know, I do a lot of talk on the air. Hopefully, however, I talk about things that encourage people to act, and that doesn't seem to be the focus of the Penn University. Anyway, next door to the Penn University, actually in the same building, separated only by a kind of a partition, is Father Joel Miller's Red Church Meal. And we're going to get into the tape, which actually usually has me stalking about with my tape recorder, commenting and getting other people's comments.
We'd like to think Jesus came back, but it was a little different than the Jesus that they know.
We have about 55 people who are in the church at tables listening to Father Joel. And who is this natty man with a tie, a new hat, and highway patrol glasses? What is this?
Are
you going to join the patrol? Is that the idea?
These are actually
mirror sunglasses.
Glasses that I wear to protect my eyes from the UV light, because that will burn your eyes and do bad things.
Indeed. Now, tonight you're going to be speaking at the Sanctuary Campground Film Festival, Hing De Boop De Ba.
I'm going to be speaking at the Real Film Festival.
There you go.
That's what it is.
Yes,
I understand that.
Real, R-E-E-L and R-E-A-L.
Some of the films are going to be very interesting. Annette March is going to be there with her Not the Other films, I understand. And I think there'll be
there was a photo display of hers in the library recently.
At the library, it's the same thing. She has an online website, and there's going to be a play featuring the Not the Other program. She's going to have a play, and in addition to that, she'll be speaking tonight, and there'll be a film there of her work.
Will you be speaking as well?
Well, there's also a Sanctuary Camp that's going to have a film there, I believe, and then there's a panel, and I'm on that panel.
What will be your role on the panel?
I don't know. I just got asked to make 10 minutes of comments, and so I'll probably be talking about both the Association of Faith Communities' efforts to establish shelters. I'll be talking a little bit about Smart Solutions to Homelessness Leadership Council, probably.
Indeed.
And that'll be it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mentioned we actually had Brent on the radio yesterday talking at length after Jill Allen, who was the executive director of Dorothy's Place, which is a set of social services over in, well, it's a long-standing feeding program with some other things in Salinas. And more important to me,
this was all about a month ago or more.
There is a campground outside there that just happens on the street, and they were clearing it away for it to come back, you know, as they do every quarter in this Chinatown area, according to what I was told. Mm-hmm. Brent went over there, did some photos, did some video, and he had a report, and he called in, and he spoke after Jill at the program last week. Look at this. Here's a man with a real face. You need another card, man. That's too weathered. I'm sorry. Make a note of this.
Did we shed a tear? Did we do anything but just walk out? No. Patience of Job.
Oh, yeah.
And
well,
not authorized.
Too patient.
Repeated over the air.
Well, I'm going to
repeat. You didn't ask me.
No. So, continuing with what you were saying, Scott, the what I wanted to suggest to you is, if you're going to be going to, I assume you will be going to this panel, one of the issues about a sanctuary camp that Keith McHenry, a co-founder of Food Not Bombs, raised, actually this afternoon we spoke on the phone, was it seems a little demeaning for homeless people and a little insulting for people to be suggest people get into camps, or even, you know, that activists like myself and others work on the sleeping ban outside, when there are so many vacant buildings all over the damn city. And the notion is somehow that, you know, there isn't, in other words, it helps the illusion that there is no place for people to go other than these camps, which is completely ridiculous. So what do you say when presented with that absurdity?
Well, I think vacant buildings, underutilized land, vacant buildings offer a wonderful opportunity to house people. Certainly, one of the things that I'm interested in is the development of more long-term, not long-term, more permanent low-income housing.
Mm-hmm.
So vacant land offers that opportunity. Empty buildings, probably not so much, but empty buildings do offer an opportunity to temporarily house people in the form of shelters.
Underground state parkland up on the north coast.
Well, that's a whole different issue. You know, that's a whole different issue. Now you're getting into state policy. But if we can stay local,
local coastal plan covers
the whole. I can't continue this. We can't have a three-way. That's not going to work. That's all right. I appreciate it. But yeah, to respond. That's all right. To respond again. And vacant buildings to me present a great opportunity. But there have been efforts in the past to develop additional shelter facilities, a permanent replacement for the armory in vacant buildings, and
failed efforts.
I think rebuffed efforts is a better way to put it.
Hence failed efforts.
Well, right, but you can only do what you can get permission to do from the people that grant.
Ask forgiveness, not permission, is my motto usually.
If you're talking about occupying buildings, that's a different thing. I'm talking about legitimately and legally creating viable long-term shelter facilities. That's a whole different issue.
But we
certainly
see that nowhere in the country has that ever been done for the majority of homeless people. So the notion that this is going to be done in a sanctioned way, don't you think that's creating an illusion for people?
I don't know if that's true, Robert. I think it was in Hollister or Gilroy recently. There was a news article that said the gentleman down there had a huge, big vacant warehouse. He was offering it to any group who wanted to house homeless people in it. He would make it available. So there are people who are looking at those kind of opportunities. The other thing that's happening is folks have developed sanctuary camp-like facilities with
a small percentage
built tiny houses. Basically, they actually build structures on underutilized.
Give me an example of where that was done.
Brent Adams has a film that addresses about four or five of these.
No, they aren't really tiny houses. Mostly they're tent cities. Dignity Village has
some
structures.
There are actually some structures in two or three of them.
Right. But again, this is for a tiny percentage of the population and doesn't serve the people generally. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. So these attempts, which is the same problem I have with things like the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, but while it is nice for the small percentage mm-hmm. that it helps. And well, there's always this endless, what I think is nonsensical and illusory claim that we're setting a shining example. More people are going to follow it. I don't see more people following it. Do you?
Well, the AFC, the Association of Faith Communities, is a growing organization. Right now, we have about 10 people on our board of directors, and we have a few more churches participating.
Shelter increased in the last six months.
The question is, capacity has.
From what to what?
We started the program with 10, and we're now up to...
In the last 6 months, has shelter increased, is my question.
We haven't built shelters,
no.
and we haven't developed more shelters, but we are trying to initiate an effort to attract more churches.
You have churches all over the damn town, but that hasn't worked.
If we can attract them to participate in the program. However, we are at a crossroads.
Jesus back.
Well, we're at a crossroads right now, because what we have is we have an administrative structure that accommodates a seven-night-a-week shelter. So we need to be able to have the wherewithal to create duplicate that administrative structure for seven more churches.
Don't you think the shelter is more important than the structure? I mean, that's another problem I have with what you're talking about. I mean, one hears a lot about, for example, Dorothy's Place. We talked about this yesterday on the air. And I encourage you to listen to the show. It's very interesting. They get a $1 million a year budget.
Dorothy's Place is a social service program in Salinas, whose director, Jill Allen, I had on the show, mainly to talk about the much larger self-governing, self-created homeless encampment outside Dorothy's Place, which the police were sweeping away regularly, although they were also apparently allowing it to exist when they weren't sweeping it away. So it's kind of a strange situation. I haven't yet followed up on it, and I'm realizing it would be a good thing to do that. When I refer to structure here in this kind of critical exchange with Scott Gallagher, who's a very pretty tireless and regular worker around the Red Church. At least I see him every time I go there on Mondays, and he's a pretty committed fellow. And is in terms of his the parameters of his commitment, how far he commits himself, but he's there to that extent. The idea that we have a new organizational structure. I don't give a shit about your organizational structure. I want to know if you've increased shelter in the last 6 months, in the last year, in the last 2 years. And the ISSP, the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which is kind of refounded by the Red Church and other groups together, and to their credit, they're now housing 20 people at night, 7 days a week in different churches, out of a population of 1,500 homeless people who theoretically need shelter. Practically, certainly hundreds of them are looking for shelter at least. It's not that I want to hurt the morale of the people who are working on these programs, but I guess the idea that people should be directing their time and energy and expenses into an organizing effort that, even at its height, and I'll probably be mentioning this later in this discussion, housed only 80 people in shelters, which the first thing you heard, by the way, the first dialogue I had was with a woman who had had some concerns and complaints about this very ISSP program. Now, she sounds like she's a pretty intense believer who maybe... It's hard to say. Maybe she imposes her views on people. Maybe she... It's not quite clear why she was excluded, but I've heard of other people complaining they've been excluded improperly from the ISSP program. And I haven't, again, looked into the specifics of their complaints. They've even been reluctant to talk about them because they don't want them made public in the hopes that they can somehow... They don't want to alienate the ISSP program, just like people don't want to alienate the police, don't want to alienate the shelter providers, so they remain quiet when abuses, if they happen, or problems come up.
Dorothy estimated that for $20,000, and they house, I don't know, 20 people maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure if that number is correct, but it's a small number. There are, however, 150 to 200 people who sleep on the street outside without being harassed by authorities for some reason, except for quarterly cleanups that they do. And Dorothy's house, apparently, through Jill Allen talked about this, helped the people put their stuff into kind of a storage area where they could put that aside while they did this bogus cleanup bullshit. Maybe it wasn't entirely bogus, but one gets the feeling it was had little to do with real health and sanitation, or they'd be providing porta-potties. You know, they don't want to do that. So I asked her, how much does it cost to actually provide adequate porta-potties, a washing station, and there was one other item, dumpsters for the people, so that they could clean up and, you know, manage their own thing, because they do manage it. According to Brent, he gave a report that it was quite, he was amazed that it was so well run. You know, you had the dope dealers in one area, and the women were in another, and the single families were there. I mean, it was all apparently, they were respected each other in some basic way. I don't know if it's true, I wasn't there myself. But her estimate of the cost of that per year was $20,000. And yet, they have $1 million a year budget. And when I said to her, what the hell? Come on. You want to kick in, you know, what is it?
This is Dorothy's place right next to this encampment, which has $1 million a year budget, but they can't spare $20,000 to provide adequate sanitation to the folks who are right outside their doors. It seems pretty strange and pretty ironic to me.
That's $20,000 for the camp outside, you're saying?
For a year. That's
okay,
correct.
That's a camp again, which you spoke against
yes.
earlier.
No, oh, yes.
That's a camp. You
no.
said, well, sanctuary camp. So
right. But I'm pointing out to you that as an emergency shelter area, and I'm all for taking over buildings in Salinas, too, if that's something that they wanted to do and something was feasible to be done and something you get enough support to do. You might even be two, for all I know. But the fact is, what I was criticizing was this idea that you need an administrative structure and you need all this kind of oversight.
Oversight in our shelter. By the way, our shelter cost last year less than $10,000, and that included purchases of mattresses and things for people to sleep on.
Okay, 20 people.
So
for twice as much, she could take 150 to 200 people.
You're talking about outside. We're talking about transportation expenses to get the mattresses.
No, I understand.
We're talking about people to interview people to bring them into the shelter.
I'm talking about serving the maximum number of people. That's what I'm talking about.
There's no paid administration in the whole program. There's just two shelter managers who work part time.
I'm not saying
take people in, get them set up, get the bed.
You get my, un- point, Scott. My point, Scott, is, and I think you understand it, is that there's a, you know, for a very small amount of money, a great number of people can get minimum emergency shelter, and it, instead we have people, you know, pushing other things that are minuscule and token, nearly token programs. They don't. I'm not saying you're doing it to show you're good guys. You do it because you care about folks. You're here because you care.
Well, there's an argument which has been made that shelters are a band-aid, and that the long-term solution is really finding permanent housing, and in some cases permanent supportive housing, to people who are currently homeless. So one way to approach that is the 180-180 program locally, which has been
another token.
Oh, it may be a token to you, but they've already housed, what, 140-some, 150-some people?
Out of 2,000 people, that's correct.
But that's their goal was 180, and they've gotten 140 people.
By shoving other people to the bottom of the list.
How many people? Yeah. Well, wait a minute. How many people are being are staying at the Armory every night?
100.
Okay. This is 140 people who will not ever need to stay at the Armory again, who will not need a sanctuary camp.
A significant number of them.
And
another significant number would have already gotten that space, but they're being pushed aside because this is being done as a preening program for social climbers like Monica Martinez and others who are using this as a political platform, which has nothing to do with the needs of the majority of people in this community who are poor and homeless. And that's the point I've continued to make.
You know, I got to say, it's interesting. I said this a month before Monica Martinez quit her job at the Homeless Lack of Services Center and took the more, I think it's the more lucrative job, of the former Santa Cruz Community Counseling Center, which is called something else, which I can never remember what the name of it is. It's a one word that starts with E, I think. You know, I don't know how much Monica has to do with the 180-180 program. I just know that all these sort of the 180-180, the smart solutions, even Sanctuary Village now, less so Sanctuary Village is perhaps considered less respectable by the... although I think that there's, you know, certainly sympathy for it, are mentioned, you know, and this sort of by the same group of social service providers who don't want to spend any time defending the homeless against police harassment, who don't want to defend the homeless against harassment in their existing campgrounds and the property that's being stolen from them. We have a caller. Let's see who it is. Yo, caller, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I'm listening to your show.
I would imagine you were. What's your name, caller?
Pat Colby.
Hey, Pat, so what's up?
So I'm listening about the 180-180 program.
Uh-huh.
I just have a couple of comments.
Go for it.
Oh, let me turn my volume down.
Definitely do.
Turning it down, so because it's delayed. I wanted to say what's happening is, like, I myself am disabled, and I've been on the waiting list for over 8 years, and other disabled people, and disabled people with families, single-parent families, they're giving all those vouchers away to the other people, so we're not going ahead. Instead of funding brand-new vouchers to give to these people, they're stealing it from us. So that's not a solution at all. Where did all the money go that they got for this 100 homes, which is part of 180-180 program? Where did all the money go if it didn't go to create new vouchers? That's my question.
And I have no answer for that. And what research are you doing to find the answer to that question?
Well, I know someone that's doing public record, and they're being stalled because, like, HUD is refusing to send any records. The city of Santa Cruz is refusing to send records. The Attorney General of New York's been contacted. The FBI is supposed to look into the fraud. And the Department of Justice is shifting it over. I have a copy of a letter from one of our senators, Senator Boxer, who's asking about this, why these things aren't happening, and all she got was the runaround. And everyone says, well, so-and-so's it got sent here, and it's got sent here, and we're not going to do it because they're going to do it. And everything's ending up with HUD, who has been the problem all along that hasn't been held accountable for all their fraud and all their giving out money without oversight. So where did the money go? It created jobs for nepotism and cronyism people to get high-paying jobs that didn't go to the people that need it most. The homeless, the disabled, the single parents, the people waiting forever on the Section 8 voucher list.
Uh-huh.
So I thought you might want to know that.
Well, you, of course, you'd have to present your documentation about the fraud, which I haven't seen yet, but sure.
Yeah, well, it's like thousands of pages, but I'm sure that you'd
well,
love to.
Well, present one case, perhaps, in a kind of a coherent form, and it'll be, you know, more persuasive than the general argument about a fraud, which is, you know, you could, it's easy to call someone or
yeah,
some agency fraudulent.
There's some public records from Ken Cole, who's the director of the local
housing authority.
Housing authority, where it comes up that they are just diverting vouchers instead of creating new vouchers, like somewhat like where the 180-180 program kind of makes it look like. So there's all these large corporations in on it, Chevron and things like that. So I'll make sure that you get CC'd all these public records.
Well, no, I don't need the public records. I need a coherent, brief, and succinct statement of what specifically is the fraud, where it happened, when it happened, who did it, how much it was, and so forth. That's what we need, because it's, you know, vague accusations of fraud are, you know, vague accusations of fraud.
Starting with the 100,000 homes campaign.
Good.
So,
well, when you've got
talk to the person to get a summary.
Good. Well,
I can tell you I saw a document where it said that they were diverting.
Well, caller, you got that's not good enough. You need to actually have something you can show the community and we can speak about here on the radio. Otherwise, it's just, you know, trust me kind of stuff. And I can't do that.
I understand that. Yeah, it's just hard to compile, but I do have to say I did see a public record.
Any other thoughts on, is there anything else you want to say on the subject before I roll forward?
I've been trying to find out stories of success, because I know there's one person that was on the 180-180 program, and she said that it was too much of a hassle. They were always, like, inspecting her and telling her what to do, that she finally dropped out of it. It was such a big hassle, and she found a room for rent somewhere in Boulder Creek. So I've been asking I would like to talk to people for these success stories. So far, they haven't produced any actual concrete.
Well, we did get a call from Red and Crow a show or two ago stating that they actually... I don't know if it was a call. We got an interview with them at the Project Homeless Connect where they said they had been accepted in the 180-180 program. Red has terminal cancer, and she's been living in a vehicle with Crow for years. Crow's an outspoken activist who calls into the show regularly with reports from Watsonville. So he was happy with that. So we have gotten one positive.
They actually got housed.
That's what he said.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. There's that one person. I haven't heard.
Two people,
you know.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, let's wait until we get more information and then call back.
Okay.
Thanks. And you call in, callers, if you've got some information, you got some specifics you want to talk about, or even some general comments, although you may see me grilling you like I was grilling our last caller about the particulars. 427-3772 is the call-in number, and... can also perhaps have a little musical break. We can all kind of relax a bit.
Sitting here in this boxcar, God knows where I am. I just got through waking from dreaming of you once again. Don't you know that it hurts so bad? Your memories come hanging round. That's when I pick my feet up again, pick them up and set them down. I
Now you know this life of a drifter is the loneliest a man can find. You're always dreaming, you're always searching, and you're always one step behind. But you keep on trying. You keep on trying till the hope's all gone. There's no reason to keep going on. And you wish you could hang your head down and cry. So now I'm sitting here in this boxcar. God knows where I am. And I just got through waking from being drunk once again. And I drink it down. I drink it down and the pain goes away. Another drunk, another day. And I wish I could lay right down.
Was C.J. Stock from his album Before the Rain. The name of that song is Boxcar Blues. It's one of his discs. He doesn't perform on Pacific Avenue anymore, and he says he's gotten tired of the police harassment, and he says that quite bitterly and quite angrily when I run into him. And he's I don't know if he's homeless or not. He has a burly, unkempt look about him sometimes, so maybe it's just, maybe I do too, and I'm housed, so don't know. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert, and this is, of course, your Free Radio station at 427-3772, if you want to call in, 427-3772. Give a call in if you'd like. Let's hear some more from me and Scott Gallagher arguing it out at the Red Church. At issue is whether the current programs actually that Scott Gallagher is supporting are really going to do anything more than act in a relatively token manner toward homeless folks and only provide for a very small number of them compared to the whole number that are there. And whether that doesn't that kind of isn't that something we have to acknowledge, and whether that's likely to change based on simply pursuing the same strategy of I don't know, looking for donations, encouraging people's charitable impulses, going to city council members, and I don't know, asking them to this is being done privately. It isn't even asking for government support. Going to one church after another and trying to get them to do what they've declined to do for the last three decades or stopped doing about 5 or 6 years ago.
Another significant number would have already gotten that space, but they're being pushed aside because this is being done as a preening program for social climbers like Monica Martinez and others who are using this as a political platform, which has nothing to do with the needs of the majority of people in this community who are poor and homeless. And that's the point I've continued to make that continues to be ignored by,
well,
bureaucrats here and there.
The problem
and even good-hearted people like yourself.
The problem is I think there are really significant efforts to deal with the issue of homelessness in this community, and I think it's
unnecessary adversarial and kind of mocking to say because they're starting up and they're not building, they have built a small number of solutions at this point, that it's not going to work with this token. I really think 180-180 has a great possibility, that approach in the future of doing this, but it's going to take more Section 8 money for this community, and so there are people working on that.
Well, I heard the same thing 25 years ago, and I've been watching it for longer than you have, probably.
Sure.
And therefore, that doesn't mean I'm righter than you,
no,
or, you know, but not at all. And therefore, I've seen this same cycle go around. Not quite the same. There are obviously differences. But in fact, unless you go to the guts of the problem and talk about immediate need for shelter and housing now, the immediate need to stop harassing homeless people now, and I know this concerns you. I don't think it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it concerns people like Brent. But there's become, their division has emerged, and you know, and among the activists, maybe you can see it here, in that those who are supporting, you know, this sort of, I don't know, it's a sanitized token approach to dealing with this whole situation instead of recognizing we have an emergency right now.
Well, I think we need a multiplicity of approaches.
Now, yeah.
So from my point of view, the effort to get people into permanent supportive housing or permanent housing, 180-180 through other programs, are wonderful, wonderful approaches. I also think it's a wonderful approach to build more low-income housing. I think it's also a wonderful approach to have a sanctuary camp. There's a lot of things we can do, but we're going to have to do them all in order to take care of 3,000 people.
You didn't talk about things like defending encampments that currently exist in Santa Cruz. That's something else you think is a wonderful thing.
Well, I don't have any opinion on that. Because I don't have an opinion on that.
Why not?
Because I've studied the sanctuary camp thing to some degree. I haven't studied where those existing camps are, whether on
they
private.
Come here property. Every week from those camps, man. Why would you not know that? You know,
I don't know the location or on whose property they are. I haven't studied that issue.
But obviously, they need a place to go, and if they're being arrested and cited and driven away, doesn't that concern you?
So if we provide enough shelter or camping spots for those people, we'll solve the problem then, because they won't need to camp on somebody else.
And that isn't happening and isn't likely to happen, isn't being planned to happen. What's happening now is they're being driven away from everywhere. On any public property, it's illegal to put up a tent in this city.
I know, even your front yard if you own your own property.
Unless it's shielded from the street by ice.
It can't be visible from the street, that's right. If your kids want to camp in your front yard, they can't do it, as I understand it, unless
it's
shielded.
Well, you can't be too careful. These kids might be homeless and they might be...
No, I'm talking about if your own kids...
They might be needle users.
If your 10 and 11-year-olds want to go out and camp...
Well, you know, sometimes drug addicts start at an early age.
You never know.
If you talk to Ann Alicia Q...
I'm not going to comment on the camping ban. I'm not going to comment on those things because I'm not really working in that area. I'm working in the area of trying to provide solutions for people.
To me, it's I'm not going to comment on your comment.
We have elected leaders. They have positions on these things. They're deliberating these issues.
No, they're ignoring these issues.
Well, no, actually, the elected leaders have imposed the camping ban. They're not ignoring it at all.
No, they didn't impose it. They're just simply allowing it to continue. It was imposed decades ago through the police department.
By elected leaders.
By other elected leaders.
Right.
No one opposes.
I'm talking about your current council. I'm talking about generally generally government has imposed sanctions on camping on other people's property and on government property. That's a fact of life. The question is, can government, can the private sector, can the public sector work together to find places to house these people in a meaningful way that allows them to participate in the community, not as aliens, not as outsiders, but as living, breathing members of the community? That's my question.
Well, the only question to me is, right now, what do you do with harassing of people tonight? Not in 20 years, not after the first 90 of 180 get out.
Well, we do it here at Calvary Episcopal Church on one night a week, and some other things other nights a week, but on one night a week, we provide a safe, peaceful place for people to come, share,
and I like that. I'm here with
and dying.
And also to chat
and
as well.
Meal and have a warm, nutritious meal.
For about 3 hours away, after which time they're driven off the property. Pretty strictly.
So,
folks like that.
I think we need a multiple
once a week. If you only eat once a week, it's a good idea.
Well,
I like it.
You can go up to Circle Church and have a meal up there on Tuesday night.
That's true.
There's other churches that serve meals on other days. St. Francis Soup Kitchen is serving meals every day.
That's true. A lunch every day.
Well, it's a meal.
And the Homeless Lack of Services Center, does serve a meal twice a day.
I think that's true, too. So there's a lot of nutrition around.
Put on your hiking shoes and hike around, and you can find a meal.
Yeah, there seems to be plenty of nutrition in this community. The problem is there isn't any place to sleep. That's the problem.
Well, I think it's a combination of things, but I certainly agree with you that there is places to sleep are few and far between.
Few and far between.
We've been talking with that jaunty-looking man about the Calvary Episcopal.
Scott Galloway.
Thanks, Scott.
Not so jaunty.
Jaunty.
Not so jaunty.
I think you look jaunty.
No, I just looked like a... I just didn't think a baseball cap went with a tie.
I think it's cool. Well, let's listen to some music here. We have a bit of psychological advice from
Stephen Trump.
And Stephen, what's your approach when you're feeling blue?
When I'm feeling blue, I usually like to take a form of positive feeling, either from a... Normally, I started with a past mental image, which is a good way to start for most people. But now I can normally summon it just by the feeling itself. And you take the feeling and push it inside of yourself and let it expound until it kind of blends with you. And then your mood starts to lift.
This is without tobacco, alcohol, or other intoxicants?
Completely. You can do this without any type of...
Is sex involved here?
You could definitely use sex to stimulate a heightened sense, but you do not need it for this technique.
How about art?
Art is a beautiful, beautiful way to uplift you. As if you heard the music in the background, it was gorgeous. And that is a great way to uplift your mood.
Fair enough. Now, we've been listening to
Tony on the guitar.
And to the man about psychology.
Steven.
Any other reports, Stephen, about anything happening downtown in the last week?
Well, there's been lots of different goings on, but as a majority, I've seen the heightening expanses of people's minds and beauty within them shining through has been expounding greatly, and I love it. And I'd like to see more of it within the town, of the people and the people living on the street, the people in the houses, everyone. You know, get some beauty in the life.
Here, here. And not no particular specifics you want to bring to that happened in the last day or two?
That's a difficult question to expound upon.
We'll let you ponder that.
Yeah.
So we have a rather distressing report from
Robert.
And you have your pooch with you.
Yes, I do.
And you observed a guy getting jumped, or you heard about it?
I didn't see it, but I saw the bumps and bruises on him. He was
getting jumped.
Cleared off somewhere and got beat up. And then there's another guy, a friend of mine, who found out he got jumped by someone. I'm not sure about the whole story about that.
Now, were you at the vets hall doing the movie thing last night?
Oh, yes, sir.
I understand you got some hassle because of your pooch.
I did, yeah.
Tell me about that.
I went in and the administrator told me I couldn't be in there unless my dog was a service animal, and she's not documented or anything as a service animal.
Subject of this had to do with what, rape in the military? Or?
I have no idea.
It was in the vets hall.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that's the building, as I understand. That was
it. Was.
And so, and you yourself are a vet recently back from the wilds of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yes, sir.
And so, it seems a little anomalous for them to kick out the vet who wants to watch the movie and use the vet's hall. Isn't that a little strange?
Right, yeah, that seems a little weird.
But you left without saying, spare this poor dog and this vet, let us stay, or anything like that?
No, I just didn't want to make a scene of it. I just walked out.
I, on the other hand, would have probably made a big scene, because I don't like that kind of shit. But yeah, for sure, man. I mean, you know, come on. Anyway, anything, any other details about this that come to mind? I mean, did anybody say anything? Whoa, what are you doing to this guy and his dog?
Yeah, a friend of mine. He went back and gave him what for. I guess the guy who did it is not even a veteran. He works for the county or something.
Administrative hack, perhaps?
Exactly. So,
Lungs Jim gave him the wherewithal.
Right. He did. He sure did. He could have been... It's almost like he practiced being rude to me when... You know,
control
when
freak.
He really did seem to be. Yeah, he couldn't have been...
Well, I'm sorry. Welcome to... I like your dog. I like the way it looks, anyway.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, she's great. She was being just herself. She wasn't making any noise. She wasn't... she was just...
You weren't threatening to kill anybody in there?
No.
Using any military training?
No, sir. No.
That's your majesty.
Well, I guess... Yeah. I guess My anger management is probably the training that...
You're pretty mellow.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with...
Robert.
Thanks, Robert. Any reports? What's your name?
I'm Jonas Bailey.
And you said that you were tackled by a housed drunkard?
Yeah, because there's a lot of drunk people doing random things, but...
Where was this?
This is just on the east side of Santa Cruz.
And what were you doing at the time?
I was walking down the street towards my friend's house.
And what did this guy say?
Just being drunk, you know, people like to prove themselves really strong, you know, and anything you say can potentially piss a drunk person off pretty badly, so just be nice as possible.
But did he say anything to you indicate why he tackled you?
He said I thought I was really badass or something like that.
Well, Mr. Really Badass, whatever, we've been talking with...
Huh?
Again, your name is...
Oh, Jonas Bailey.
Thanks, man. All right. Hey, you were told
that the grass on the backside of the government center by the sheriff is for government workers, jurors, and people that work in those two buildings, and citizens of the county only.
Wait a minute. Who told you this?
The sheriff.
And you, the sheriff or a deputy?
A deputy sheriff.
Do you happen to notice his name by any chance?
No. Okay. I didn't catch a name.
And what were the circumstances in which he decided to give you all this good advice?
We were sitting there.
And how many were you?
Me and my wife.
And incidentally, was this guy white or black or brown?
He was a Caucasian.
I see. And why do you think he targeted you? I mean, you are of darker skin, and you have a hat on, and a strange-looking trumpet on your key ring, but other than that...
I don't know. Wrong place, wrong time.
We're homeless?
Yeah, we're homeless.
You were present when this happened?
I'm there a lot of the time. Usually we're all together. It's him, his wife, me, and my husband.
And have you been hassled there as well or not?
Oh, yeah. The cops came up to De La Viega Park the other night and decided it's okay to flash lights in people who are epileptic space, and then put an M16 up my nose and caused my husband a seizure, and then refused to tell me to... They're yelling at me to get my dogs. They're yelling at me, my friend who was there helping my husband, because they wouldn't let me get to him, to get away from him. And they let him flop for 10 minutes.
How many of them were there?
They came in about between 6 and 7 squad cars deep, 2 cops in each car with M16s and 9mm.
And what were you doing? Planning to blow up the country? What was your plan?
No, apparently somebody called because a white male... Do I look like a white male?
No. I'm afraid not.
And came up there in a gray hoodie, sweatshirt, and a beanie cap, and threatened somebody's life.
I see. So they decided to respond in force.
Oh, yeah, they responded in force, and they repeatedly told me and my husband, no, me and my friend, that we know you're not the ones we were looking for.
We'll fuck with you anyway.
But yeah, we're going to continue to cause the man to have a seizure, and then you start putting the flashlights in the eyes of the other epileptic. Thanks a lot.
And we've been talking with?
Cece.
Thanks, Cece. Tell me more if you want. Here's when it'll be played. You probably have one of these, but just in case you don't.
And I did everything and anything that probation wanted me to do, and they guaranteed
you just
me...
got out of jail.
Yeah, and they guaranteed me 90 days SLE money, and then...
What is SLE money?
SLE money, it's for sober living environment.
Gotcha.
And due to me, I was doing a thing, if you would do half your sentence, you can get capped out, and you're on an ankle monitor. It's a new thing.
No, I don't.
But I did my full sentence.
Okay.
But, you know, due to that, I did not get the ankle monitor. Probation switched their mind and all of a sudden said that, hey, oh, no, there's no more funding for you, after they came and interviewed me and guaranteed me 90 days SLE money.
So you didn't get any money?
I didn't get nothing, and I got kicked to the streets.
So you're sleeping outside?
Yeah, I'm sleeping outside, yeah.
And you were sentenced for what crime, if you wish to say?
Not completing the program.
Which was?
Drug court.
And why did you decide not to complete it?
I started using, you know, due to...
Heroin, meth?
Just, it doesn't matter what I was using. Alcohol.
Alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol, and then alcohol leads to other things. But.
Yeah. What are you planning to do to sleep tonight?
Just find somewhere safe.
Did you sleep last night anywhere?
Yes, of course. Yeah,
not hassled?
But, no. not hassled, but, you know, I mean, you got to find, like, you know, difficult places to sleep. I do get hassled, but, you know, I mean, I finally found somewhere to sleep where I don't get hassled.
And you want to say who you are?
I got one.
No, it's all right. Thank you.
But thank you, man.
Yeah.
And here's where it'll be broadcast. So, what's your name, man? If you want to say.
Phil.
Go ahead, Phil.
So, about a week or two ago, my friend went missing in a party out in the woods, right?
Right.
And so, I came back down here later that night. No, he didn't show up, so I went to file a missing persons report, right? So I called the cops and said they were going to come meet me. It took them, like, 2 hours to come meet me. And I kept calling him back. They were like, yeah, I'll be right there. I'll be right there. Da-da-da. It took them, like, 2 hours. And then when they finally got there, I told them what happened, you know. And the second I said that, when they asked me my friend's address and my address, and I told them that we were both homeless, the cops started, like, completely ignoring me and, like, just, like, treating me like shit pretty much.
Name of the cop?
I don't remember. It was one of the sheriffs.
How long ago was this?
Like, about 2 weeks ago.
And anything, did your friend ever reappear?
They went on to say that because he was homeless, they weren't going to send out a search party for him. They were just going to flag his name down, and if a cop ran into him, then they would mark him down as okay.
Charming. And we've been talking with?
Phil.
Thanks, Phil. So, we're talking with?
Robin.
And you say, Robin, the cops have been, how would you describe it?
A little more higher in numbers.
And what have you noticed about this specifically?
A lot of them being assholes.
For example?
A lot of tickets. They're not walking bikes and stuff.
Anything recent you've seen? Or?
I saw that they pick up a younger African-American brother and told him he was crazy and detained him and had him get a mental evaluation.
Was he crazy?
Which they'd released him because he wasn't.
What was the pretext for picking him up? What was he doing that you think attracted their attention?
I don't know. I really don't know.
And how much of the whole thing did
profiling.
You see? How much of the whole thing did you see?
Most of it. I saw him get cuffed and put into the car.
And where did this happen?
Right out in front of the shoe store on Pacific by Subway.
How long ago?
Yesterday.
About what time?
Two-ish?
Has he been released?
Yes.
How's he doing?
I saw him today. He said he's good.
Did he give you any reports about what went down?
No, he said they didn't charge any file any charges, and they released him. And
did you get a hot dog or a free meal or anything?
No, I don't know. I didn't ask that one.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so I was glad to see him.
Anyway, thank you. We've been talking with
Robin.
Thanks, Rob. We're talking with Anonymous. You say were you upset that no police showed up?
No, that was great.
We could call the police.
No, that's okay. that doesn't happen very often. I think it's like the second time ever I haven't seen any cops at all. Normally they drive like up in front of New Leaf or whatever, you know.
This is in the city limits or outside?
Oh, yeah, right. Like downtown.
You don't have to say where you are unless you want to.
Okay, I'm done.
And how many people were with you in this situation?
I'm okay.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. And if you want to... What's your name, sir?
Ryan.
And Ryan, we know you. You're the child of you and Michelle has been taken into a foster home, or is about to be taken into a foster home?
It has been taken into a foster home. Michelle has been given visitation with the child. However, because I refuse to provide their defense for the CPS, they won't give me the visit.
Provide the defense.
They want me to meet with the lady that made all the accusations and told her and tell her what's not true about the accusations.
What are the accusations?
Well, you know, we went through all that before. They said that we were driving with her in the car, not in the safety belt, which was completely untrue.
Okay.
The different things. But they refuse to. They're holding things over our head, and they won't let me see her. But either way, the main point is that Michelle shows up at these visits. The baby is completely filthy. Dirty food from head to toe, no socks or shoes on, and she's kept in a house with five other children, and is not being cared for. So they took our baby out of a potential that something would happen, and they put her in an abusive, neglectful situation where she's currently not being taken care of.
And we've been talking with
Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks.
Red Report talking with.
Hi,
I got out of jail, they treated me like a piece of crap the whole time.
Tell me about that.
They told me I had an attitude on the way out. I got harassed by guards, and I'm glad to be out of that nut house.
When were you jailed?
I got locked up on the 24th of April, and I'm out today, which is
28.
Luckily, I have the public defender had a heart and talked some sense, and the judge got me released.
What were you charged with?
Just a probation violation.
And what was the nature of their probation violation?
They got me for trespassing, sleeping outside and stuff. I was told I was trespassing by the Santa Cruz Police Department, you know.
Did you leave when you were told that you were trespassing?
Oh, of course, because if one refuses to leave, they use violence against that person. So it's there.
Where were you supposedly trespassing?
I've been busted trespassing all over Santa Cruz.
But this most recent incident was?
At City Hall, probably. I can't remember. It was a few years ago.
And so this was an old incident, or this was a recent one? I mean, you were jailed 4 days ago, right?
Yeah, I was in jail recently and got out today. But yeah, it's an old incident. I left town. I went up to San Francisco, so they call it absconding when they catch you. So yeah, I'm done with the probation. The public defender was very nice, had it terminated, and I don't know probation anymore. Any type of probation or anything like that. I'm just trying to stay out of trouble, stay off drugs, get a job,
get a bite to eat,
stay good up here.
Fair enough. We've been talking with.
My name is Ivan. I'm from San Jose.
Thanks, Ivan. Appreciate it. So we have a man who's trying to prepare the world for first contact.
Yes.
What's your name, sir?
Travis.
And Travis, how long have you been on this mission?
About 13 years.
And why did you begin this mission?
Because I was given a sign from heaven.
And when did that happen?
14 years ago.
And what was that sign?
Well, it was a dream right after September 11th. My friend turned on my TV, and I saw that. I thought to myself, oh, my God, this is the beginning of the end. And when I went to bed that night, I had a dream.
What was that dream?
That the aliens were going to come save us because something major was going to happen to the planet and a lot of people were going to get hurt.
Was it a verbal message? Did you see people coming down?
No, it was a dream.
I mean, in a dream.
It was a dream.
Was it verbal? Was it visual? In the dream?
It was visual. Very clear, vivid, and visual.
And what did you see?
I don't want to say.
You don't have to.
But what I do want to say is I've been telling everybody that the aliens, because we can't leave our planet, the aliens were going to come down here and give us a hand and help us for those who believe in God and Jesus Christ and follow his way.
What about the Jews?
All of them.
Islam?
It doesn't matter.
Atheists?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Just checking here.
You know?
I want to make sure we're not getting discrimination by the alien group.
My friends. They have a closer contact to God.
Have you met these people?
Not in the flesh yet. But
well, get to it.
Yes.
You know, to come out of hiding. We need some help.
But see, now I saw on the internet today that Professor Makaiku or whatever the guy, he's a physicist. He just went on the internet telling everybody they should prepare for first contact or visitation from aliens.
Fair enough. And we have been talking with
Travis.
Thanks, Travis. So you have a concern about people behaving here in the church.
He's right there. He's right there.
Yeah, so I didn't see the incident
right there,
but
thank you.
We're talking with, if you want to say.
Well, it's really disrespectful towards parents and, you know, their children, you know, to yell on them, which is not kosher. You know, if you can understand what I'm saying, that's all I gotta say.
Well, thank you for the update. All right, go ahead. For free radio, mind if I do a recording?
Oh yeah. So anyway, like after the great earthquake happens, and the buildings fall partly on the sidewalk, then what are the laws about playing drums and music and stuff?
We'll have to check that out when that happens. In the meantime.
Yeah, that's the one. That's me. I just want to make an announcement or two in case you're interested. There are free movies today over at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. It's a ways away. It's over the river on Ocean Street.
Promoted the sanctuary camp once.
And I'm not promoting that, by the way.
Pardon.
But I'm mentioning there are a number of camps. I wish there were a camp over there. But instead, there's just movies. And if you want to check out the movies, you can. Make up your own mind what you think is good and bad. There's also other stuff happening, but I'm going to be having a meeting on Wednesday, if you're interested, at HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet at the Sub Rosa Cafe, which is where you can get some free coffee if you come to the meeting. We want to talk about stuff, whether we talk about tickets, we talk about what to do around harassment. We don't have a lot to do, but we try to figure out what we might do. So come if you're interested, and I'll be around here if you got stuff you want to talk about. I also do recordings for Free Radio Santa Cruz, as you probably noticed. Thank you, and thanks to the musicians.
Thank you.
So we're talking with...
We just have to kind of keep moving. We can't sit down for long under trees. We can't sit down in nature very long. We just keep getting escorted off properties and off. Even if it's public parks, we just can't, you know. We just got to keep moving, that's all. So I'm praying. I have a vision for a place for us to go stay away from here, up in the, you know, up the mountains. People are escaping. They're getting lucky. They're getting a blessed with a place to go.
Visions are nice, but unfortunately right now, tonight, you'll be sleeping indoors, but others will be sleeping outdoors.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel for... I did sleep one night on a sidewalk. It was cold, and it was scary, but I made it through. I didn't sleep, really. I dozed. But it's scary for women alone. It's really scary. So.
And we've been talking with?
Val.
Thank you, Val.
And that kind of concludes the April 28th interviews at the Red Church, which I think that concludes it. Maybe we have a few more, but while I go searching for them, perhaps let's listen to a little more C.J. Stock.
Does it feel, my friend, when you know
Yeah, that was another one by C.J. Stock, whose album is... I'm not sure where you can find it. You might be able to find it online. It's possible. The actual name of that particular number was Hitchin' Free. Don't know if I followed all the words, but it had a nice, quiet quality to it. In case you just tuned in, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3. I'm Robert Norris. I do a show from 6 to 8 every Thursday and on the Sunday mornings as well. And if you want to call in, the number is 427-3772. Looking at a few clippings here, which I rarely get time to get to. I'm going to make a little time here. I'm noticing one from about a week ago. Council okays funding for downtown safety, as the Sentinel likes to put it, because the sight of a homeless person, of course, means that... There's always the perception of lack of safety, and that's certainly more important than the reality. It's like when you see those hook-nosed Jews wandering around in 1930s Germany, you never can tell when they might cook one of your babies or do something like that. In other words, I'm suggesting that, yes, there is a real parallel between the harassment of groups like Jews in Germany and homeless people in Santa Cruz and other cities, for that matter, but particularly in Santa Cruz. Anyway, City Council, as you probably know if you've been following the show, on Tuesday unanimously approved spending nearly $200,000 to support a new city-county program, and here we begin to get into the fiction, designed to offer services, largely treatment for substance abuse and mental health, to people who are routinely arrested downtown for intoxication, illegal camping, or other problems. I mean, obviously, these people who are illegally camping have some sort of mental deficiency for which they need treatment. I mean, why do they need to sleep at night? I mean, what is their problem? You know, obviously, you know, what you have here is the cover story that we're dealing with, I don't know, drug abuse or mental illness or, I don't know, inveterately contrary behavior, when what you're actually dealing with is survival behavior by people who are poor and outside, by displaced urban residents, by people who have lost their jobs, by people who have disabilities. And the idea, you know, $200,000 could fund, theoretically, at least porta-potties and dumpsters if you use the Salinas, California estimates of Dorothy's Place Executive Director Jill Allen. They could provide... Well, like she said, $20,000 could provide dumpsters, porta-potties, and wash stations for 100 to 150 people who camp in the streets outside Dorothy's Place services in Salinas. So if you... this means that 10 times that many, 1,000 to 1,500 people could be served in small camps with those kinds of facilities if you wanted to actually deal with the real problems of... lack of emergency shelter immediately, where people could actually, they'd have to find, of course, their own tents. They would have to find their own sleeping bags and their own blankets. They'd have to organize themselves, but at least they'd have restroom facilities, they'd have washing facilities, and they'd have trash facilities, which would be a good step in the right direction. Instead of people doing that anyway, taking a crap where they have to at night, having no place to wash up, and so having to use restaurants' bathrooms to wash up in, and also no place to dump their trash, so then they can be accused of littering and given littering tickets. It's clear that the issue is not really to provide the kinds of services that would address these problems, but to scare these people away. That's the whole point. To terrorize them, frighten them, and drive them out of town. It's called the Downtown Accountability Program. They call it the DAP program. I kind of like to call it the DORC program because of the foolish and actually nasty kind of mentality behind it. But it's being covered with this sort of brand name of treatment. But in fact, as I've mentioned before, there is only $3,000 of this $200,000 in the program for any kind of actual housing. The majority of it goes to pay coordinating officials who will be assisting DAs, probation officers, police officers, judges, court staff, city staff, to make sure they target the people that are most visible downtown and who violate those serious public safety laws, having to do, for example, with illegal camping, that need to be addressed. That's nothing to do with public safety. But again, if they have to use these labels like public safety and drug treatment and so forth, and so they're doing it all for health and welfare and safety. See, it has nothing to do with bigotry and NIMBYism and the economic growth that some merchants feel will come if the homeless community is significantly reduced or driven away. As if that could happen anyway in terms of people who live here. Actually, I think it can happen to some extent. It already is happening. We have another story, violent protest against police injures officer. And by the way, in the studio with me is the esteemed Michael O'Grady, who just slipped in past the guards. He got past the security fence without even providing his ID. I'm going to have to talk to those people. Even at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, supposedly they're racing to put in a security fence and a set of IDs for all the people so that the criminal and sex pervert is not able to slip in, particularly those who are engaged in other crimes like, I don't know, illegal camping, which they shouldn't be doing. And they should know better than to do that, right? That's certainly where it's at. Let me ask you, Michael O'Grady, why don't you belly up to a microphone over there and tell me, what's the status? Have you seen any evidence of this exciting new security gate and fenced off area?
No, I've not seen. I've heard some people talk about it briefly, but I've not seen it. I think it's going to make the whole place look like more like a jail, or having a big gate across the door there, and having everyone with identification cards. Yeah. So, I don't know. I haven't really formed an opinion about it one way or the other in a hard way, but I think it's going to change the tone of the place.
I see. Well, here's an article from Salinas. Violent protest against police injures officer. Now, you may remember that Salinas has been the scene for the last couple of weeks, and you can read a lot about this on Santa Cruz Indie Media, of protests because of the shootings of three different people in the last, I think it's the last month. But instead of researching that, we have the Chronicle, in this case, talking about a police officer was injured when demonstrators protesting recent police shootings in Salinas attacked officers as they tried to assist a victim who had been shot in an unrelated incident. The officer was struck in the head with a bottle Wednesday night when performing CPR on the victim, when protesters swarmed responding officers, some throwing rocks, bricks, and bottles, according to the chief of police's account. As the crowd swelled to as many as 1,000 people, officers from other agencies were called to assist. The officers, some in riot gear, were able to push the protesters back from the crime scene. Police said Diego Garcia, 26, was arrested on suspicion of inciting a riot, resisting arrest, and, of course, that favorite, violating probation. Garcia taunted, and I say that because the rules for violating probation, which I have not studied, but which I have heard about sort of anecdotally, are very easy to violate. And this is a nice way of providing full employment for probation officers, courts, judges, and those who build jails and staff them. Because, you know, if you get arrested and start serving time, let's say, for being a chronic offender downtown for sleeping too many times, and that's what you'll do, by the way, in spite of what Bob Lee piously states when he goes to the Santa Cruz City Council, or the Sentinel falsely reports, because the substance of the DAP, Downtown Accountability Program, is once they try to send you through one of these treatment programs and it fails, their next step is to send you to jail for sleeping, for chronic offending, for sitting too many times next to a building, for essentially disrespecting the authority of those who claim that certain kinds of basic human behaviors have to be avoided, censored, kept out of sight, or else you will suffer criminal penalties. Those people who want to suggest that that's wrong, or who just ignore that because they feel it's necessary, homelessness is bad enough without having these additional difficulties thrown at you, they will suffer jail. And that is the lie that is being promulgated, is that they won't.
Quite a few criminals in jails, they won't take probation because they know the rules are so difficult and so hard that when they do get caught breaking them, they actually add extra time to the original sentence. So that's why quite a few of them, they don't like taking...
And you get that information from where?
Well, I get it from actually people who were in jail.
Because I thought probation, if you break probation, you simply have to go back and serve the rest of your sentence.
Well,
unless you've committed a new crime. But I don't know for sure if that's true.
That's what I would have thought. But that's the information I got was from some people who spent time in jail. And they say no, they give you extra time. So I suppose I could check it out.
Definitely.
Sure.
Let me know if you come up with anything new.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't know if the protests in Salinas are continuing. They certainly were big news a few days ago, and they were big news on the Santa Cruz Indie Media, the website that I often use, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. I'm going to take a look right now and see what I can find. And we'll take a peek here. Salinas on Sunday, May 25th is the latest, and the top story is families, residents, and statewide supporters fight for justice in Salinas following the SPD killing of Carlos Mejia, whose name is not mentioned in this article about the poor officer who got hit by a bottle. And I'm saying, I don't think it's any fun to get hit by a bottle. It's even less fun to get shot dead by Salinas police officers and have no meaningful accountability for that. And that can produce a lot of anger, particularly when it happens three times in a short period of time to three different individuals. Continuing with the story, on May 25th, local politicians and nonprofit groups worked to quiet anti-police sentiment at the large march and statewide mobilization against police brutality held in East Salinas. On May 27th, the family of Mejia filed a wrongful death legal claim against the city of Salinas, and a May 31st counter-protest was held at a pro-police rally organized by retired Salinas officers and law enforcement families. Additionally, public pressure led the Salinas PD on May 28th to release the department's policy manual on the use of deadly force. The killing of Carlos Mejia was the third police shooting by the SPD, the Salinas Police Department, to occur in a short time span. On May 9th, Osman Hernandez was shot and killed outside the Muy Pueblo Market on Alice and Sanborn Streets. On March 20th, so it was 3 months ago, three months, Angel Ruiz was shot and killed outside of a Wingstop restaurant. All of this has been set against the larger narrative of law enforcement misconduct in Monterey County, which has been characterized by the alleged targeting of Hispanic individuals by King City police, as well as the killing under mysterious circumstances of a man in Big Sur by a Monterey sheriff. And that's, if you want to check out, there's a lot of stories, pictures, and other some video at indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. It's again one of the main stories. There's an article also on the Santa Cruz 11 that's also online. I read earlier Brent Adams' kind of brief account. Here's another account of the hearing that happened on Tuesday in Santa Cruz, again for people who are still being accused of essentially being in a building after a police warning and therefore bearing complete responsibility for all vandalism that occurred in that building, even though there is zero evidence that any of them committed any of that vandalism personally. That's under the aiding and abetting theory that has been used to draw out these cases in the two and a half year period, certainly two and a third year period that they've been going. And the article reads, after a court hearing this Tuesday, the DA's office faces disqualification and the remaining defendants are left without a trial date. The case continues to cost taxpayers thousands and the defendants, I'd say hundreds of thousands, and the defendants continue to fight their charges. The show must go on and on and on. Never failing to be surprising, the Santa Cruz 11 case saw yet another interesting turn of events, with Judge Burdick still in place presiding over the case. After the DA's office's attempt to recuse him, it seemed that the hearing on Tuesday would leave us with a new trial date. However, the defense attorneys have been busy and filed a motion to recuse the Santa Cruz District Attorney's Office from the case, which I mentioned before earlier in the program, based on the bias stemming from DA Bob Lee's financial relationship to the victim, quote-unquote, of the case, Wells Fargo Bank. The motion casts doubt as to whether or not it is fair for the DA's office to be hearing the case and delays the trial again as the motion is dealt with. It is likely the DA's office will request a specific hearing challenging the validity of the claim, as it would look pretty damn bad on Mr. Bob Lee's report card to have this claim on public record. Perhaps this move will motivate him to either get involved with the case and authorize a reasonable solution, or at the very least, detach himself from the case and give Prosecutor Greg Pinedo the ability to move the case along. Due to the lack of clarity as to who will be trying the case, a trial date was not set. A pretrial hearing. I thought that the recusal motion against Burdick was gone; it would have been thrown out, so they do know who's trying the case, but maybe not. A pretrial hearing was scheduled for August 27th, where the motions will be heard. There was also an earlier date or two scheduled to address motions filed by individual attorneys. Besides the main recusal motion aforementioned, there are numerous other motions on the table from the defense, including a separate motion to recuse the DA's office for the poor handling of the case. Judge Burdick made a number of public remarks regarding the opinion and is clearly trying to find a way to end the case. He said it was too old and it was clearly in everyone's best interest, the court, the defendants, the DA's office, and the public, for a resolution to be found. He also said the only way the four defendants could be held responsible for the total amount of alleged damages above or around $20,000 would be if they were proven to be the leaders who directly enabled unnamed others to enter the building and subsequently damage it. Defense attorney Jesse Rubin responded by acknowledging that the Occupy movement, from which this case comes, Burdick actually called the case the Occupy case, clearly identifies itself as leaderless. The topic of restitution was a big one, and the subject of at least one pending defense motion. The DA's office argues that the total damages should be split between the four defendants, while the defense attorneys cite the police department's estimate that there were 150 to 200 people involved and argue that the total should be divided by that number. The difference being thousands or hundreds of dollars, Burdick seems somewhere in the middle. Attorneys and the judge met off record to discuss a potential deal that would involve a misdemeanor plea, 3 years informal probation, and a cap of restitution at $1,250 each. This has not been offered yet and remains to be seen what, if any, deal these defendants would take. It is worth mentioning again how absurd this whole process is. Hundreds of people took over an unused and ostensibly empty bank building, occupied it for a few days, then cleaned up and left peaceably. Wells Fargo, the most profitable bank in the U.S., hired out-of-town businesses to drive in from over the hill to clean up and encourage them to boost their costs. They claim over $25,000 of damages. The city of Santa Cruz asked for public help to identify participants in the occupation and eventually charged 11 people with the four original offenses, including felony conspiracy. Over 2.5 years later, there are four defendants facing two charges, and the taxpayers of Santa Cruz have funded the case that has cost well over $100,000. The DA's office has already been sanctioned for failing to follow court orders, and now Bob Lee's relationship to Wells Fargo casts clarity as to why things are where they are at. Over and over, we say it, enough is enough, drop the charges. And that's, again, by an anonymous group called Friends of the Santa Cruz 11. So, you can read more, and plus you can add your own comments if you go to indiebay.org, Santa Cruz Indie Media. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Phone number here is 427-3772. Your turn to call in quickly, or just enough time for you to zip in a call or two. I'm going to Am I going to read some of these clippings? I'm not sure. Oh, it's interesting. The Sentinel here has editorialized supporting Let the Sun Shine on Public Records, and I certainly agree with them. It's a March editorial. And they note that March 16th is the first day of the annual Sunshine Week, a national initiative to promote a dialogue between the importance of open government and freedom of information. Participants include news media, civic groups, freedom of information organizations, libraries, nonprofits, schools, and others interested in the public's right to know. And so they note that California has an extensive Public Records Act, which I've been using, actually, to some effect, getting information from the police department on the number of bicycles they've burglarized, by the which I mean they have refused to pass on to nonprofits and instead are selling off at an auction, at a faraway auctioneer, and declining to tell us how much money they're getting, at least so far. That's one of the things the police department has refused to give information on, though they are giving only a I think it's less than 5% of the bicycles are actually going to people here in Santa Cruz, the Teen Center, which is the group that the city council, trying to penalize the bike church, has sent the bicycles through. So public records is an important act, and hopefully I've been getting, every time you come back and ask for more information, you put more pressure on them, and you eventually get information that can be helpful. We have actually, Huff has gotten records that we are now looking through more carefully to show that homeless people in the last year in the downtown have been ticketed more frequently, far more frequently, than housed people. Particularly in relation to the number, their percentage, their numbers on the streets, although we don't have a scientific count of the total number of people who are going up and down Pacific Avenue every day. It's always been my impression and my concern that homeless people receive an unusual amount of attention from police departments, security thugs, as I call them. However nice they are to you as individuals, they're still thugs. They're paid to drive you away from public spaces. They're not paid to keep order. The only order they're keeping is an order created by the merchants and the city council, which criminalizes homeless people at the whim of a police officer or a bigot or a merchant or anybody who wants to activate the tripwire net of downtown ordinances. And you can see that actually most vividly when you look at walk down Pacific Avenue tonight. I doubt you will find a single performer, well, you might find one or two, who is in a legal spot, that is, a spot that is actually legal. And that's not because they're lawbreakers, and nor does it show the police are lax in enforcing really stupid laws that criminalize, what, 95, 96, 97% of the sidewalk from any kind of public First Amendment use of that sort? No, it is because police know they have not got the time to go after people unless they decide they want to, in which case they do. And so people remain in a state of significant insecurity regarding what they can do in Santa Cruz and attempts to get the city council or even Micah Posner and Don Lane to propose that all tickets be suspended until there is real clarity as to what laws the police are going to enforce and what laws they're not, or make laws that the police can actually enforce and do so consistently and effectively, though I hate to say that of any of these downtown ordinances. And I heard Posner actually came to one of our meetings. He's a council member in Santa Cruz. And he didn't come to. He happened to kind of come by, and he shook everybody's hand. He smiled, and you know, he said he's really trying to make incremental change. That was his phrase. And I didn't have much patience with him, but some of the members were pleased to see him. They think he's sort of, if not the sweetest thing next to white bread or you know, I don't know, chocolate cake, he's our best hope. And of course, based upon his performance and that of council members, that's ridiculous. The best hope is for people who tell the truth about these issues. And, you know, they can then vote whatever way they want at city council, but they have to speak the truth. And that's something that neither Posner nor Don Lane does on these issues. in terms of the actual amount of space being stolen from the community, the amount of hardship and grief being visited upon homeless people in terms of the costs of tickets, and also just doing the basic research that would bring these issues to the public notice. And I and others in Huff have been working on this issue to do that, and hopefully I'll have more information for you at a future show. But I was going to just say about the Sentinel, which, you know, as a newspaper, because it relies on public records to some extent to do the few investigative research stories it does, when it doesn't simply copy handouts from the police department or the city staff. It does mention that the Public Records Act doesn't cover the courts or the state legislature, doesn't apply to privileged personnel information, and that that should be taken care of. And there was also an amendment on the ballot that on Tuesday's ballot that tried to shore up the right of those of us locally who demand public records. And what some localities are doing, and I'm not aware Santa Cruz is doing this, is they're saying, we can't give you those records because we can't afford to pay for them, because the state legislature is not paying for them to us. And that, of course, is another one of the dodges. It's not that hard to get public records. In fact, I mean, to provide them. And it's also outrageous. And if you try to get a copy of a court record, they will charge you 50 cents a page to get it, which I recommend people not pay. I recommend they demand the supervisor come over and say, print it all out, let me take a look at it, I'll photo it with my cell phone, if you have a cell phone or whatever, you a camera with you, or I'll take notes on it. You should not have to pay for court records that are supposed to be public. Ditto with the police department, which is charging you 50 cents a page. However, what you can do, and you are able to do far more frequently these days, is get emailed public records, which are then free. They don't cost anything, and you can download them or look at them yourself online. I'm particularly cranky with the Sentinel because they don't seem to care about my situation when I attempted to audio record at the City Council on April 1st and was arrested because I insisted on placing my little archaic tape recorder in the position that it had been in for two decades before, not interfering with anything, not disrupting anything, at its usual spot, which is on the banister between the City Council City Clerk, or maybe she's the Assistant City Clerk, and the main speaker in the podium. And I was arrested. I wasn't taken to jail, but I was arrested. I was charged with a misdemeanor, and it's still hanging over my head. It was not actually, when the court date came, the DA said, well, we weren't sure whether they're going to charge you or not. But it's still an open case.
They'll hang it over your head for as long as they can.
Perhaps.
Keep pressure on you. That's their policy.
And perhaps the only way to address it, as I've said before but not done, is to simply go back to City Council again and do exactly the same thing and ignore and just proceed as though there were civil liberties in Santa Cruz, and let them not be successful in intimidating myself and others from doing this. It's just it's a grueling kind of situation because you have to prepare for jail to do that. Anyway, I wrote an editorial about this, which I think I showed you, Michael, and you gave me some input, and you actually wrote a letter about this to the National Law Center for Homelessness and Poverty.
And they called you, didn't they?
No, they haven't called me. I can't hear you.
I wrote a letter to two organizations. One was to do at the First Amendment, right? And the other one was one of the persons contacted you a few days later.
No. Neither of them contacted me by phone. I did write letters to Peter Scheer and Terry Frank of the First Amendment Coalition, and they did write me back. And when I attempted to further discuss it, I haven't heard anything from them. But that is their real neck of the woods, open public meetings, the right to get into meetings, to record them, to have access to public documents, all that's important. My concern about the Sentinel is that they kind of buried the arrest story, but then a reporter got interested in the story and did a separate story on it the next day or the day after. That was, I think it's Jessica York, I think her name is. Sorry if I got your name wrong, Jessica. And I haven't heard anything from her since. Of course, there hasn't been any more news on this issue, really, except the city council has been stonewalling when I've asked them, provide for me, you know, the rationale for what the actual disruption would be for putting a tape recorder in this position, why you need to have it not there. And maybe they might, if they haven't said anything, you wouldn't think that maybe Pamela Comstock and Lynn Robinson and Cynthia Matthews would mutter something about clutter, like they do about the reason to sweep away street performers and vendors downtown is to eliminate the appearance of clutter. I don't know what their rationale is. I know that it's wrong. And I know that I've expended an exorbitant amount of energy and time on it, and it's very frustrating. I also attempted to have an op-ed piece printed in the Sentinel. And I was told 2 months ago it was on a waiting list, and so far it's still waiting. I suspect that, you know, I shall have to be, you know, I don't know, burned alive at high noon on the city council lawn for them to take an interest and maybe print a post-mortem editorial or something. But that's not always true. The Sentinel has in the past sometimes done that. I am, however, reaching the end of my time here. There's about 3 minutes until the show is over. So I'm going to end this with a little more music from CJ Stock. And thank all of you who have been listening for listening and denounce you all for not calling in. But if you want to reach me off air and with apologies, promises, and a large financial stipends, you can reach me at 423-4833. I'll be back on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning. Is that the time I'm supposed to get up to come to this place? I think so. And then you'll hear more, and I'll talk more. Unless, well, we won't even talk about the alternatives. Thanks for listening in, and coming up next, it's Uncle Dennis from the Cream to the Dregs.